Good morning, and I'd like to call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Today is the 22nd of March, 2005. It's now 8:35 a.m., and we have Senator Guest, Senator Huggins, myself, Senator Seekins, Senator Terry, and Senator French will be joining us soon. Senator French has been here or just left the room momentarily. We're going to start this morning on SJR 10, the sponsor of Senator Dyson. Welcome, Senator Dyson. We're eager to hear your introduction this morning.
Let's see, had we already started a hearing on this bill before?
No, this is first time on this one, in this committee.
Pardon me,
things melt into
many bills going on. My memory wasn't good when I was young. Thank you for hearing the bill. 1998, the people of Alaska voted to amend our state constitution to limit the terms and conditions of generally referred to as marriage as being between one man and one woman. And I think that passed at the ballot at high 60%, close to 70%. Since then, 43 other states have done similar, and most of us thought, you know, that was the end of the issue. But in fact, courts now in three states have Massachusetts, Vermont, and California have made decisions casting doubts upon whether the what will go on with marriage. We have an interesting difficulty in our country of what of the requirement that all courts give full faith and credit to the decisions of other courts. And so now marriages which were performed in Massachusetts between same-sex couples, there's the difficulty of what do other states do with those marriages. And already they've had the interesting, if not ironic, conflict of the court ruled in Massachusetts that same-sex marriages could be fine, but the court was absolutely silent on divorce, and now some of the couples that got married haven't been able to figure out how to get divorced, and it's just produced some very strange things. So the federal, in U.S. Congress, a bill has been introduced to have a federal Defense of Marriage Act, and what we are doing here is just as a state encouraging the feds to do so, so that there is uniformity across the country on this issue. The you can certainly question, and people like myself, probably Senator Huggins, who tend a bit towards the libertarian side of civil liberties issues, we really question when should government get involved in these really deeply personal issues. And there's certainly precedent. And in our country, marriage in lots of ways is treated like a contract. And you know, all of us have had friends that have got all wrapped around the axle in divorce settlements, child custody cases, and all of those sorts of things. The first time I've been able to find that U.S. government got involved in the marriage issue was about 10 or 12 years after the Civil War, and had to do with the polygamy issue, and whether or not states who had legalized polygamy or territories could be admitted to the Union. And there was a pretty rigorous court case on that, and finally was decided in federal court that marriage was only between two individuals. You couldn't have more than one spouse. So anyways, there's precedent for it. I think it's worth doing. I think we need the continuity and the consistency across the nation, and all our resolution does is tell the federal Congress that it is the consensus of this legislative body that we want that consistency.
Questions for Senator Dyson?
I'll ask.
Senator French?
Senator Dyson, why isn't this a question of states' rights? Why don't we just let each state and the people there live in that state decide how they want to define the institution of marriage? I mean, we in Alaska have a constitutional amendment. We've settled it. There's no question about it. There's never going to be any gay marriage in this state. We've got a constitutional amendment that says so. But if the people of the state of Mississippi or Texas or Florida or wherever want to define marriage differently, what do we care here in Alaska?
Yeah, and I answered that question in the first part of my remarks. And
sorry, I wasn't here.
That's right. And my answer was brilliant. But I won't make you wait till you get the record of the thing. The issue, as far as I'm concerned, and I started out with exactly the same position, you know, and was that our courts, our law requires that each state's courts give full faith and credit to the court's decisions in other jurisdictions. And the decisions, particularly Massachusetts, but it's troubling, maybe Vermont and California, but already the issue has come up is what happens to same-sex couples married in Massachusetts when they move to another jurisdiction, and how do those other jurisdictions in which, you know, deal with that? And an irony, and you, as prolific a reader as you are, you probably have seen it, but the courts in Massachusetts, in authorizing marriage, made no provision for divorce, and already some of the couples who got married under the Massachusetts thing have not been able to figure out how to get divorced, and so on. So it is my understanding that that's exactly the genius or the idea of why the federal legislation has gone forward, is to bring consistency and across the nation. And as I understand it, Senator Hollis, 43 other states have done as we have done.
You say done as we have done, you mean a constitutional amendment in their own constitution, or you mean supporting the federal marriage resolution?
Have defined marriage as between one man and one wife, but I'm not sure, I'll find out for you, I'm not sure all of those did it in constitution as opposed to
by statute.
I'll find out for you.
Senator Dyson, the Massachusetts decision was done by the courts or by the people?
I believe the courts, sir.
Senator Huggins.
Well, Senator Dyson, I think that's exactly the point, and one of the perspectives that you and I share is that the confidence in how the people feel versus a person sitting on the bench sometimes run direct opposites of one another, and we could find ourselves in the state of Alaska essentially being told by a person sitting at the bench that who cares what the law or if the Constitution says you must honor because of something that happened in Massachusetts. Is that what we're getting at?
Yes, sir.
And
it's pretty intriguing, but you know, 150 years ago in our country, when we were finally beginning to confront the issue of slavery, there were many people saying, using the argument that I have used in other places, hey, states' rights. Your view as an individual, matter of choice. If you don't like slavery, don't own one. And if your state doesn't like it, fine. But the real push on that came with the Fugitive Slave Act, which under federal law forced anti-slavery states to use all the power of their courts and their police to return runaway slaves to back to their owners. And people in the anti-slave states just really took umbrage at their courts and their police and their jails being used to return, you know, people to slavery, which they thought, as I do, is absolute moral outrage. And I don't think it's not, you know, I'm not as outraged at our court or our system here having to deal with somebody else's same-sex marriage from another state, but kind of a similar issue. And finally, you know, we fought a war over that one. One of America's bloodiest wars.
The questions? Senator French?
Thank you. if there were some way to carve out an exception to the full faith and credit clause with respect to these unions, would that satisfy your concern? Because the way I hear you and Senator Huggins discussing this idea, and I can see the concern is that we, a state that's point blank said, we don't tolerate, you know, holy matrimony between two men or two women. We don't do that here. And we don't want to be put in the position of having to honor that holy matrimony union from another state. If there were a way to carve out an exception for those relationships, would that in some way, I'm not saying you're going to pull this resolution, but I'm just, you know, talking with you about the idea, would that cause you to be less concerned or cause you to be less supportive of a federal marriage definition?
Yeah, good question. Probably would not cause me to be less concerned, but I would have less urgency about it.
I certainly could support that to some degree, but anyhow, other questions for Senator? Thank you very much, Senator Dyson. We appreciate it. We have one person who would like to testify. Mr. Ball, is it? Welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee. If you'll put your name on the record for us, and we are eager to hear your testimony this morning.
Thank you very much. My name is Michael McLeod Ball. I'm the director of the Alaska Civil Liberties Union, and I'm very intrigued with the discussion. All of these are great and wonderful points, and I spend a lot of time thinking about them, and I appreciate the effort that you folks put in. But we oppose the resolution, as you might imagine. Let me just start by talking about the full faith and credit clause, if I could, for a bit. I don't know what the answer to that question is, and I don't know of any particular cases that have taken that on directly. Historically, I think we can draw some analogies. I'm not quite sure how directly applicable they are to this particular situation. But it seems to me that if you have a couple that's married in another jurisdiction, I don't know if those folks, I think it's a question of jurisdiction of the matter that would come before the courts. And so if that couple has moved to Alaska, they subject themselves to Alaska's law. Now, that doesn't mean that their marriage in Massachusetts or wherever is invalid, but in terms of the relationship and any contractual or legal disputes that arise between the two of them, that gets interpreted under Alaska law. Or it seems to me that the Alaska courts might be asked to interpret Massachusetts law, but I don't think there's anything in there's anything that would require Alaska courts or Alaska companies to acknowledge the validity of that marriage under Alaska law. So I don't know exactly the answer to that question, and I think it's a really interesting legal question, but I don't know that the answer to it is as hard and fast as Senator Dyson might argue in support of this particular resolution. With that, let me just say that we support the extension of full marriage and domestic partnership rights to all couples. And there's no question that the proposed amendment to the U.S. Constitution would work against that goal of ours. But we would take the position that you don't need to be a supporter of gender-based marriage equality to oppose this federal marriage amendment, and accordingly to oppose the passage of this particular resolution. We think that liberals and conservatives and libertarians have good reasons to oppose this particular bill. And in particular, I would point to two well-known conservatives. One is Bob Barr, who's a former member of Congress and actually was the author of the Federal Defense of Marriage Amendment, who has taken a position in opposition to this kind of legislation in states. And it's basically on a states' rights basis. I'd be happy to provide the committee with a copy of his testimony before the before Congress in opposition to similar kind of legislation. But I would say that Mr. Barr is the 21st Century Liberties Chair for Privacy and Freedom at the American Conservative Union. He's on the board of the National Rifle Association, the Patrick Henry Center, and serves on the Legal Advisory Board of the Southeastern Legal Foundation. I would also say he consults on privacy issues for the ACLU as well. As I said, he authored the Defense of Marriage Amendment, and he What he says in particular, though, if I could just quote briefly from his testimony before Congress, says, by moving what has traditionally been a state prerogative, local marriage laws, to the federal government, it's in direct violation of the principles of federalism. In treating the Constitution as an appropriate place to impose publicly contested social policies, it would cheapen the sacrosanct nature of that document, opening the door to future meddling by liberals and conservatives. Third, it's unnecessary as long as the Defense of Marriage Act, the federal law, is in force. That's his testimony before Congress last March. March 30th of 2004. And then also John Haynes, who is the chairman of the Wyoming State Judiciary Committee, or at least he was at the time, his testimony on that same day in 2004 before that same committee. In his testimony, he describes himself as a lifelong Republican, a lifelong conservative, and he was, he was elected to serve first in the Wyoming House of Representatives and later, and at the time, in the Wyoming Senate. He also opposed the passage of the legislation. He said he urged Congress to refrain from passing an amendment to the U.S. Constitution, preempting the states from making their own decisions on marriage. But more importantly, state courts have over 200 years of experience in deciding which out-of-state marriages they will recognize. The states are already well equipped to make these determinations for themselves. In short, these conservative representatives were concerned about the federal preemption of the state having the ability to make its own decisions in areas that are that have traditionally been areas for the states to manage and to legislate in regard to. From my own perspective, I would like to be able to preserve the right to help work Alaska toward a position that's more in keeping with my position and our organization's position on this particular issue, but that doesn't mean that we can't all work together toward that same goal for different reasons. I would also say that even if some people oppose marriage equality, most people think we shouldn't be able to discriminate by gender with respect to legal protections and benefits that accrue to married couples. And this legislation on the federal level at least has the the potential to take away rights such as hospital visitation rights, inheritance rights, pension rights, and that sort of thing that you would normally associate with married couples. So, in any case, that wraps up my comments. I'm happy to answer any questions, but we would urge you, as Wyoming did when faced with similar legislation, urge you to not pass this resolution. Thank you.
Question, Senator Terrio.
Neither of the gentlemen, or perhaps they did in the written piece. How do they deal with the full faith and credit issue?
In their comments before Congress, they didn't make any reference to that particular issue. Again, as I said, I think it's an open question. I think it's a good legal question, but I don't know that there is any black and white answer to it.
So it seems to me they just chose to ignore it.
Possibly so. I don't know if they were asked to address that or not, sir.
And with regard to the statement, which there's a long history of which out-of-state marriages they will recognize, and what's that based on?
Are you talking about the quote from the?
You made a quote.
Yeah, let me just pull that up. That through the chair, this was Senator Haynes from Wyoming. His testimony, and I'm just quoting from his testimony. He said state courts have over 200 years of experience in deciding which out-of-state marriages they will recognize. I don't want to speak for Senator Haynes, but I will say that I think what he's talking about is that in this area of family law, it's traditionally been an area reserved to the states, and the federal government has by and large stayed out of that particular area of lawmaking. Not that the feds don't have the ability to usurp the state rights, but I think his point was that it's traditionally been in the area of states' rights. State courts have been making decisions in this area. You know, some states will decide issues over here, other states will decide issues over here, but because it's traditionally been in the states' area, if you pass a federal constitutional amendment, that precludes the state's ability to make those decisions for themselves in the future.
I think it only precludes the state courts from making those decisions. And in this case, the people of the state of Alaska have said 70%.
Yes.
Marriage is one man, one woman. Why not allow the people of the United States to make that same decision? Why allow the courts to do that?
Mr. Chairman, I believe the issue is whether you want the people of the United States making that decision for people in every state.
I believe
That's a good question, but I believe the courts will make decisions that the people won't. I think that many times, depending on the makeup of a court, you'll see a decision that'll come down that's contrary to what I think the people would do if they were asked how they felt about an issue. And so in this case, you know, I have no problem entrusting America's people to look at this institution, which I think this institution kind of transcends the area of whether or not we should have management rights of our submerged lands or our waters or our wildlife or something like that. This strikes to the very core of an institution that's been around, you know, since recorded history. So, you know, I think it's a very important issue that the people's voice should be heard on this. And so I don't have any problem trusting the fact that if this went forward and was came out of the Congress and asked the people of the United States, do you want to do this? Then the people speak, and they speak as 50 different sovereigns, and they speak as also the people of the United States of America at the same time. Other question, Senator Huggins.
It's Mr. Ball, right?
McLeod Ball.
Okay.
Senator Huggins.
Which one do you go by?
I go by both of them.
Michael Work?
Michael is fine, Michael. Yes.
Okay. Michael, I'm glad to see that you're quoting Mr. Barr from Georgia, and I hope he has some good influence on your organization, because he has lots of other things to say on
He already has, Senator.
I would encourage you not to cherry pick, but choose some of his other philosophies, because it might have good bearing. You know, if you're in the Cars parking lot in Wasilla, Alaska, and you start talking about the permanent fund, there are some people that would kick your favorite black lab if you mention things like, well, you could be a non-resident of the United States of America and draw the permanent fund. But in fact, you can, because a judge told us you could. And that's the sort of thing that brings to bearing the inconfidence of what will happen to the destiny of things like we're talking about here today. And I think that's a rising, it is a sad day in the state of Alaska and the United States of America where the people understand and have shown their will by a supermajority, and then you turn around and the ruling is directly contrary to that. So there's a growing inconfidence between the will of the people and some of the findings that are just, you know, some people would say, judgmental and not brought to bear objectively in law. So as I look at this, as strongly as anybody believe in states' rights. Unfortunately, I think the case of one person sitting behind one bench making judgments that falls directly contrary judgmentally to what the people feel, there's a growing inconfidence for that. That's a sad day in our state, and I hope you and your organization will help us out on that in the future.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, if I could, and this is partially in response to your last comment, Senator Seekins. The judiciary is burdened uniquely with having at times to ignore the will of the people.
Would you say that one more time?
The judiciary is burdened with being mandated to ignore the will of the people at times. We have a democratic society, yes, one person, one vote, but we also have a Bill of Rights, which sometimes sits at odds with the will of the majority. And that's what makes our country perhaps different from any other country on earth. We do have certain rights that are absolutely protected, regardless of what the majority would prefer. And so the judiciary, if it were not for a strong judiciary, one that has the ability to interpret the laws of the land, that has the authority of judicial review that was memorialized first in Marbury versus Madison back in the earliest days of our country, were it not for that authority, we could have a situation where we regularly abuse people's rights in the minority because the majority feels otherwise. And I'm not saying that's this particular situation right now that you're talking about, but I do feel compelled to at least stand up briefly for the judiciary in that regard.
I'll have a comment on that, but after Senator Terrio.
You're absolutely right. And certainly if you look back at civil rights, the civil rights movement when it first began, if you put that to a question in front of the people, what would So I agree with you on that point, and that's why although I quite often, most often, disagree with the advice of your groups, you know, it's part of the process. Mm-hmm. It seems though that what we're being asked is to let a problem, instead of proactively taking care of a problem that we see coming down the pipe, just let it develop. You know, let that problem about, well, whose jurisdiction can a Massachusetts marriage be enforced in the state of Alaska, just let that develop and we'll deal with that problem when we get to it. And although you're right, the judiciary is bound by the Constitution, all the checks and balances go around in a circle. The people have a right to propose changes or to make changes to the Constitution too, which are then binding on the judiciary, and that's one of the things that's being asked for in this resolution.
Through the chair, I will just say a good example is what happens in a divorce context. If a couple has moved here, if a same-sex couple has moved to Alaska and has subjected themselves to the laws of Alaska, and they want to get divorced. I can envision a situation when they go into Alaska court and they say, we're married in Massachusetts, we want to get divorced. I'm not quite sure how that situation gets resolved, but Senator Dyson is correct, Massachusetts has not addressed that issue, but that doesn't mean that there's no answer to that question. It just means the courts are left with the burden of resolving that issue. It seems to me that an Alaska court may have to interpret Massachusetts case law to come to a resolution of that particular issue. But I don't know that necessarily means, in that case they're splitting up the marriage, so, you know, what do we care, right? But I don't know that it means that Alaska is forced to recognize that marriage. The courts may be burdened with the effort of having to undo it in that particular case. But I don't know that means that we're having to give our blessing or imprimatur to that union.
Of course, I think the very process that we're encouraging to take place here, where it be asked of the people whether they want to amend the Constitution, is exactly the same process that they could use if they wanted to amend the Bill of Rights. So, you know, the majority of the people, or the supermajority of the people, could even change the Bill of Rights, couldn't they? So with that in mind, I think there's nothing wrong with asking the people. I think that's all that Senator Dyson is asking that we do, encourage the United States Congress to ask the people.
Senator Seekins, I agree that there's absolutely nothing wrong with the process. We've got a good process. It's worked for a long time, and that's fine. We would take the position that in these circumstances, this particular amendment and this resolution is not necessary. We have in Alaska, the state of the law is what it is, as Senator French has already mentioned. And also there's the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, the statutory enactment that's been that's in place on the federal level. And so we see this effort on the federal level as sort of a way to drive a wedge between two sides of the American public, and in fact, similar comments were made in Mr. Barr's testimony. We believe it's unnecessary and it's not healthy for the country.
Senator French,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I'm concerned about civil rights and specifically civil unions. What in the Federal Marriage Amendment or in the Defense of Marriage Act would prohibit or I work against the idea of civil unions?
It's an interesting question. I'm not sure that I can give you a short answer on that. What our concern is that the federal amendment would get in the way of providing the benefits that have been associated with civil unions. In the states that have acted in that regard, some states have carved off marriage as one man and one woman, but have preserved the right of civil unions, and that's how they've gotten around their own constitutional issues, and in effect given all the benefits of marriage or the contractual benefits of marriage to same-sex couples. It's our concern that if the the federal marriage amendment is enacted into the Constitution, that that would somehow inhibit or get in the way of even those benefits being being provided by the states that choose to give them.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I wish I could give you a more complete answer as to what that mechanism is, but I can't at this point.
Appreciate your being here very much. Is there any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
I don't see anyone else signed up to testify on this particular bill. Is there anyone from the audience that wished to testify today that has not indicated so? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony on the bill. Discussion among the members. I don't see any problem. The people of the state of Alaska were asked whether or not they wanted to reserve the institution of marriage to one man and one woman, and I don't have any problem asking the people of the United States if they want to do the same. So is there a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move that
Senator Huggins?
I move that Senate Joint Resolution Number 10 with attached physical note and individual recommendations be moved out of committee.
Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Thank you, Senator, for being here this morning. We're going to move next quickly here to Senate Bill 67. Senate Bill 67. We have 5 people that would like to testify on Bill 67 this morning. We'll start in Fairbanks with Mr. Ward Mertes. Mr. Mertes, are you with us this morning?
Yes, Chairman. Thank you.
Mr. Mertes, if you'll put your name on the record for us, we're eager to hear your testimony this morning, and welcome to the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you. My name is Ward Mertes. I'm a trial attorney from Fairbanks, Alaska.
And by the way, I will, for the record, tell you that Mr. Mertes and his family have been my attorneys since 1977.
Thank you. We're addressing Senate Bill 67 as a proposed cap of $250,000 for non-economic damages in personal injury actions brought by health care providers. I'd like to divide my 3 minutes, if I could, into 1 minute each to discuss the concept of individual responsibility, the concept of trust, and the concept of value. Responsibility is a fundamental aspect of every step that needs to be taken in Juno, I might respectfully suggest. And whenever we take a bill and we lower a person's responsibility, we invite the corresponding social aspects. For example, if you take police off the street, we know what happens to the speed of the motorists. It goes up. If you reduce the responsibility of anybody, then their incentive for being careful, for being sober, correspondingly down. It's simple human nature. It's the same human nature that we employ when we suggest that young females who are pregnant should be responsible, and we shun abortion. The responsibility argument that we make when criminals suggest that their time in jail should be shortened, we say if you do the crime, you should do the time. It's the same responsibility we address when we tell poor people that social institutions were not meant to carry them, but rather to assist them for short periods of time. Social responsibility is an enormously important component of everything we do in Juno. The minute we start limiting that responsibility for someone as important as a doctor, I think we're taking a step in the wrong direction. Senator Seekins' Senate Bill 67 sponsor statement cites two rationales. One is that we have less insurance carriers and less doctors. That might be true. In fact, it probably is true, and I'm curious if anyone has investigated if capping personal injury and non-economic damages will bring the carriers back. It's really pretty simple. If anybody could show me the piece of paper where the insurance carrier, any insurance carrier, said that this bill will, one, reduce premiums, or two, inspire their friends in Alaska, I would have to change my testimony, because right now, as a trial attorney, I'm very much opposed to Senate Bill 67. Senate Bill 67 sounds like it's smart, it sounds intelligent, but unless we have a commitment out there beforehand, I suspect we're playing into the hands of the insurance industry. The simple matter is that if I may move to the concept of trust, we either trust the juries or we don't. Jurors are made up of our constituents, Senator Seekins. You, me, whenever you apply for a permanent fund dividend, There's an invisible mark on the application that says, I also want to serve as a juror in the state of Alaska. It's our constituents. It's the people who are voting. It's the people who are in this room who are listening to this testimony who sit on juries. If we can't trust a jury to do the right thing, to value a human life, not to value the wages you'll lose, not to value your medical bills that can be done by an accountant, but to value a human life, to value human suffering. If a doctor, drunk or inattentive, draws the wrong vial, pulls a syringe, and pierces the skin of your four-year-old grandson, thereby rendering both his kidneys inoperable, terminating his 75-year life expectancy to that of about 20 years on dialysis, his losses are now going to be capped at $250,000. Because a bill like this does not apply to the frivolous, to the stupid lawsuits, to the people who sue Burger King because they're fat or spill coffee in their lap. The bill of this magnitude only punishes the people who are severely and horribly injured. If you think about it, the caps don't get the little stupid lawsuits that should never be filed in the first place off the table. They only cap the big ones where people are horribly injured. And they tell you, they say, Senator Seekins, they say you're worth $250,000 beyond your wages and medical bills. Mr. Mertes, you're worth $250,000. The rest of the people in this room, you're worth $250,000. And that just isn't right. We either trust the juries or we trust the judges. I've practiced law in Fairbanks for 17 years now. In every single case, and I mean every single case, it's not me who demands a jury trial, it's the insurance industry. The insurance attorneys demand a jury, a constitutional right to demand a jury in every single case. And for the last 10 years, I filed a document that says, Judge, I would like to proceed without a jury. Let's just do it with the judge. And every time the judge says on the record, Mr. Mertes, I'm sorry, it's a constitutional right. The insurance industry asked for their jury. They're entitled to it. Why would the insurance industry ask for juries every single time if they don't trust them? The simple fact is the juries in Alaska are notoriously cheap. This is Alaska. I was born and raised here. If you don't have a bone sticking out of you, you ain't hurt. And if you have a bone sticking out of you, you're probably not hurt that bad, and it isn't worth that much. Understand that the $250,000 cap is only going to affect those situations where a person is horribly, quadriplegically injured, where their life was taken from them because somebody was drunk or stupid, because somebody who is not going to get the wrong incentive to continue in their medical education or to be safe and careful or to simply go home when they're tired and let another doctor or nurse do the job is no longer going to have that incentive. If we had a piece of paper saying that the insurance carriers would come back, that the insurance carriers would lower their rates, maybe we have an argument. I don't think we have it now. The $250,000 limit, please be aware, is only for non-economic damages. The wages of people who are earning a living right now, personal injury attorneys like Ward Mertes, auto dealers like Ralph Seekins, all of you in the audience who are earning a good income, your income is preserved, but your life is devalued. It isn't fair and it isn't right. You either trust the juries or you trust the judges or you trust your constituents or you don't. The bottom line is that we don't have a promise for any type of rate decrease that I know of. And if we do, I'd love to see it. And we simply have to insist that the responsibility of our doctors, the people who hold our lives in our hands, are exactly the people we want to be responsible, just like the car dealers, just like the attorneys, just like the people who work in the factories, in the fields, the people who have blue collars and work up in Prudhoe Bay are absolutely responsible and accountable for every dollar of damage they cause. And doctors are paid a lot because they take big risks and they do important things. When people take big risks and do important things, they have to be sober, they have to be careful, and they have to comply with standards of care. So I respectfully submit that I disagree with Senate Bill 67. And I urge you to either get a piece of paper saying this is going to make a difference in the long run, maybe we'll get some of those carriers back, and maybe doctors will be willing to come to Alaska, or we take this one off the table. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Mertes this morning? Seeing none, Senator Terrio.
Mr. Mertes, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the current system, which is $400,000, but you can get around the cap, the workability of that, the way it works in your practice. the ease with which you can get around the existing cap.
Let me help you there, Senator Terrio. 17 years, and I do medical malpractice work. I have never had a verdict for personal injury, non-economic damages exceeding $250,000. I've never had to worry about it. Because Fairbanks and Alaskan jurors overall simply don't award the money. If somebody is telling you that there's a lawsuit crisis out there, the jurors are giving millions of dollars for coffee in the lap, brother, it ain't happening in this state. It never has, as far as I've ever seen. But the issue of getting around the cap is a non-issue for me.
Okay, but
are you familiar with that case? Oh, go ahead.
Well, the issue of insurance, I mean, I have insurance on my house, not because I have a history of people tripping and falling down the stairs, but they might trip and fall down the stairs. And so that's basically the insurance component here is that although you've not had experience that in your practice, the next case that you take, the person might get that kind of judgment.
I don't know. I can't tell you that. But I can tell you that for 16 years, it hasn't happened in the past. And I know the past is the best indicator of the future that we have. And I can tell you that doing a number of non-medical malpractice cases, if you know medical malpractice cases, are a lot harder than a normal automobile case because, well, frankly, people love doctors. Let's just cut right to it. Jurors aren't inclined. They're very aware of this issue, and they're not inclined to award damages against doctors. So in a normal personal injury case, I can count on one hand the number of times the cap has ever been an issue. See, this just isn't a day-in, day-out. What I suspect might be happening, Senator Terrio, is that it's very much like airplane crashes. When's the last time you read in the paper about an airplane that took off, flew safely, landed, and everybody went home? You just don't read about those. You only read about the crashes. And so there's an overwhelming perception that airplanes crash when you and I both know they don't. And they do every now and then, Maury Thompson, God rest his soul, it happens. But it is rare as a hen's tooth. So if we enact legislation that damages all Alaskans by valuing their lives down at $250,000, expecting airplane crashes, I respectfully suggest, Senator, that we got the wrong end of that court, that horse we're pulling on the wrong end. It's just, it's fiction. If we could do some analysis of it, I would like to see the numbers. I would volunteer my time to help you do that analysis, jury verdict research in Alaska. Let's pull the actual verdicts and see what's going on. Rather than, right now, if we don't have the statistical analysis, we don't have the actual data that tells us this many times insurance companies have had to go and sustain verdicts that exceeded this amount of money, aren't we kind of walking in the dark here? I mean, aren't we making rules that we might not need to make? And by gosh, brother, if we need to make that rule, let's make it. Let's get the doctors and insurance carriers to come back. But if we don't need the rule, wouldn't we do a horrible injustice to that four-year-old kid who's now told your life expectancy is $250,000? That's your law.
So in cases that you've had that perhaps you've tried to get an award beyond the cap, I'm sure you've alleged that, you know, the action of the physician was gross negligence or, you know, what suggestion would you have then on how you allow an upper limit for, you know, abhorrent behavior?
Okay. The compensatory damage component is addressed by the jury. And it's just simple negligence. It's not gross negligence. Be careful of that term because gross negligence hasn't been defined very well in Alaska law. Simple negligence is what everybody deals with. And simple negligence is simply not paying attention. It doesn't put you in jail. It doesn't make you a bad person. It just means, gosh, doctor, I paid you to pay attention and to act like a doctor, and you didn't do it. For example, I have a case presently where a woman presents to a doctor with tightening of the chest and pain radiating down her left arm. Now, what would you think the problem might be? The doctor thought it was indigestion, gave her Lantus and sent her home where she probably died of a heart attack. Now, in that situation, I respectfully suggest the doctor probably wasn't doing what he was being paid to do, because I think the mouse in the corner knew that we had a heart issue going on here. And so in those situations, it's not gross negligence, that's just simple negligence. The doctor wasn't paying attention. But when you pay a doctor to do something, and the doctor doesn't do it, the doctor is responsible for the resulting damages. That's why doctors make hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. They're well paid because they do an important job. They're supposed to do it well. They take risks. But if I may respectfully suggest, the problem just isn't there. If I may be more clear on your question, Senator.
No, that's fine.
Other questions for Mr. Mertes?
And if I could make another suggestion, if you're going to pass this bill anyway, God bless you, it's certainly your prerogative, could you please put in a section that says we'll tell the jury about it? Because let's inform the juries, let's trust them a little bit to know what the limits are, to know what they're allowed to do. If a jury says, oh, we're only allowed to award $250,000 in this case, let's let the jury know that. Why would we ever hide such a thing? Because right now there's a presumption in the law that they won't know that. And there's a case law suggesting that they won't be told that. Why don't you go ahead and tell them? These are people we should be able to trust. Or we should be able to trust the judges. We should be able to trust somebody in that darn courthouse.
I'm sorry.
Is there anything further?
Other questions? No, thank you very much, Mr. Mertes. Appreciate your being here this morning. Did you have your testimony in written form?
No, I do not.
You sounded like you had it very well prepared. If you were, it was written, I was going to ask you for a copy. Thank you.
I'll type it up for you. Senator Seekins, thank you very much, sir. Thank you to the committee.
You bet. And my best to your family.
Thank you.
The next person we have in Anchorage, Margaret Louie.
My name is Margaret Louie. My husband has suffered extensive permanent brain damage and is now paralyzed on his right side due to medical negligence. Now my husband cannot read, write, or speak fluently, and the lives we work so hard to build are so dramatically changed as to be unrecognizable compared to the lives we lived before the injury. My husband was only 49, in excellent health and fitness, and at the peak of his career when the injury happened. Richard went to Caltech and law school. He was intellectually gifted. He was one of BP's most valued employees and one of their favorites for public speaking. Richard was BP's senior staff computer scientist and lead auditor for 20 years. He loved his work and he loved living in Alaska. He enjoyed fishing, canoeing, camping, hiking, gardening, working in his workshop with wood. But now, there is not a day that passes that Richard does not struggle. From the time he wakes until the time he goes to bed, it is a long day of trials. Things you probably take for granted, like getting showered, dressed, or eating. It is a labor for him to communicate and express his ideas. He struggles with curves and steps. And worse, Richard is now stared at everywhere we go. He is treated as slow and mentally defective. Non-economic losses and pain and suffering are terms that are cavalierly tossed around. You cannot imagine the loss of self-esteem from not working at your lifelong career, at the loss of your education, wiped out due to a brain injury, the loss of your communication skills, vocabulary acquired over a lifetime, the social isolation, including the loss of your friends, now reluctant to visit because they miss their old friend and they can't bear to see what has happened to you. How many of you think $250,000 is adequate for the suffering you will endure for even one of the many disabilities Richard has suffered? Is this enough to make your life better over the course of a lifetime, which in our case may be another 30 years? When this injury occurred in January 2000, we had just purchased the year before our dream home and a new car, all in easy reach for us financially. We had 6 months of savings and owed very little in credit card debt. But in an instant, we were plunged into this hellish ordeal, damaged in every way you can imagine, physically, emotionally, and financially. And with a disaster like ours, it doesn't take long to become deeply in debt. one missed payment builds on another until the interest and penalties become enormous. Today, we face a mountain of debt. And what became of our legal battle for accountability? It was a steep uphill fight for 5 years, and we never did get our day in court. Every attorney we spoke to, and eventually the attorney who tried to help us, ultimately stopped due to the extraordinarily high cost of expert medical testimony, estimated to be $150,000. We were told every medical malpractice case must meet high burdens of proof. Causation and breach of the standard of care must be proven. We have discovered the standard of care is quite broad and very tough to prove, especially in a small community. We learned doctors are reluctant to testify against each other, meaning expert testimony is hard to secure, and for us in Alaska, has to be obtained from doctors in the lower 48. Doctors charge from $1,500 to $15,000 per day for their expert testimony fees, excluding first-class airfare, hotel, food, and rental car. Also, we were told juries tend to presume all doctors are truthful. Juries trust the word and authority of a doctor. Of course, there are some bad doctors, but yet doctors are usually accorded a presumption of innocence by their community. This belief naturally requires an even higher level of evidence to prove a doctor has been careless. Also, if a doctor does not need operating privileges at Providence or Alaska Regional Hospital and operates out of the office or a privately owned clinic, the doctor is not required in the state of Alaska to carry any medical malpractice insurance. What this all means is that it's extremely difficult and expensive, if not impossible, to pursue a medical malpractice case in spite of the merits of the case. And that is exactly what happened to us. We have nothing to gain by speaking before you today. I hope you will remember that the majority of your electorate is not wealthy doctors nor insurance executives looking for ever higher profits, but ordinary real people like us who look to you to protect us. Which of you represents and cares about the true suffering of victims of medical malpractice? Terry Schiavo has President Bush and the U.S. Congress to stand for her. Will you stand for us? Please vote no on Senate Bill 67.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions? Hearing none, we thank you very much. Margaret, was your husband Richard there? Did he sign up to testify as well? Richard, if you're there, please put yourself on the record, and we're eager to hear your testimony.
My name is Richard Lewis. I've worked for 20 years at BP. I was a computer scientist and auditor. I asked my doctor about risk, but he didn't tell me. Now I cannot work, but that is what I missed the most, except for running. Please remember me. Please vote no on Bill 67.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your testimony, sir. Questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. We appreciate it. Let's move down to Juneau. We've got Brian Slocum. On the offline, is it? Brian, are you there?
Good afternoon or good morning, Senator Seacon. Can you hear me?
We can hear you, sir.
Okay.
If you'll put yourself on the record, we're eager to hear your testimony this morning, too.
Thank you. I'm Brian Spokum, the administrator of the Tanana Valley Clinic, actually in Fairbanks rather than Juneau. I am testifying in support of SB 67. I believe that the passage of SB 67 will give us a chance to bring badly needed physicians into Alaska in general and into the interior in particular. I note that a number of the witnesses in previous days have mentioned, and one mentioned today, that SB 67 is not guaranteed to solve all of our problems with respect to physician access. But it seems to me that we have to start from where we find ourselves today if we're going to fix our challenges. And it seems that SB 67 may not guarantee to fix them all, but I think it's a good place to start. I noticed that Mr. Mike Powers from Fairbanks and Lawrence Hospital last Thursday testified about growing physician shortages in the interior, and I believe it was Senator Terrio who asked if this was because of a universal problem with fewer physicians, or perhaps something that was more localized to Alaska and Fairbanks. And I'm looking at a study that was done in 2003 called Physician Statistics Summary, a review of the American Medical Association's findings. And it states that definitively from 1965 to 2002, non-federal physicians increased at a rate of about 213%, while the U.S. population growth only increased about 51%. So it's pretty clear that the data shows that the number of physicians in practice nationwide went up about four times faster than the total population. And to me, that suggests that the problem of physician shortages here in the interior and in Alaska in general are a localized problem, not necessarily because of a lack of physicians in the entire nation. And there was a recent editorial in the Modern Healthcare edition of March 14, 2005, wherein the editor said that the Graduate Medical Education National Advisory Committee predicted a shortage of up to 96,000 additional doctors by the year 2020. And a professor from the University of Wisconsin Medical College believes that that estimate was way too short, and he foresees a shortage of some 200,000 physicians by 2020. So the existing shortage that we have in the interior and in Alaska is probably likely to become far worse in the coming years. On my own, I did a quick little study of the numbers of physicians in the interior compared with Anchorage to get a sense of what the real numbers were. And according to the Department of Occupational Licensing, the number of physicians per 100,000 population in Fairbanks is about 201 physicians per 100,000. That compares rather unfavorably with the Anchorage and Eagle River area. It has about 333 physicians per 100,000. That suggests that, not counting the physicians who are practicing out at the at Fort Wainwright, we have about a 40% fewer physicians per capita than Anchorage does. That's a pretty serious problem. I note that Mr. Powers also mentioned the shortage of primary care physicians that we're currently experiencing here in town. But there was also a study that the hospital commissioned a couple of years ago that suggested that we had a potential of 31 physicians shortage by the year 2008. And I tried to translate that into what it means for the patient population in Fairbanks. Within 3 years, if we're 31 physicians short, and if you assume that each of those physicians would see an average of 15 patients per day, that suggests pretty strongly that about 465 patients on a daily basis in 2008 will not be able to see physicians when they need them. That's 2,325 patients a week and almost 112,000 patients annually that will not be able to access doctors when they need them. Now, our clinic is the biggest clinic in the state. We have 38 physicians here, and we see about 140,000 patients a year. So it gives you a sense of what that kind of shortage of physicians means. It would be like us closing the largest clinic in the state 3 days a week, and those patients would have to go elsewhere, and there's nowhere for them to go. In summary, I'd like to tell you that we have some personal experience about what has happened to the rates of malpractice insurance and what that has done to our ability to bring doctors into the state. And I want to give you a little background about that. We have averaged about 35 physicians working at Tandon Valley Clinic in the 6 years that I've been administrator. That translates to about 210 physician years of practice experience during that 6 year period. Now, we have been to court 4 times because we were sued for malpractice, and we won all of those cases. The reason that we won all those cases is that the jury determined that we did nothing wrong. We did have one arbitrated settlement that was arranged prior to getting to court, where ourselves, another clinic, and some other doctors in town settled out of court, and that's basically our history. We've had one arbitrated settlement in 210 physician years of practice over the past 6 years. But that leads to the information about what's happened to our malpractice costs. Last year in 2004, we paid $259,000 for our malpractice insurance. This year we're paying $638,000 for that same coverage. That's a 150% increase, or an increase of $380,000 in 1 year. There are only 2 malpractice carriers in the state today compared with 5 a few years ago, and I'm truly concerned about what's going to happen to our clinic and our ability to stay as a business entity if we have similar increases in the years ahead. If another malpractice carrier leaves the state, we could, in fact, find it difficult to stay in business and provide health care. And even if rates stabilize at today's level, the lack of malpractice reform in Alaska simply increases the difficulty we have in convincing physicians to come to Alaska. There's a case in point. I was talking with a lady obstetrician about 3 weeks ago who was currently practicing in Wisconsin. We discussed the practice opportunity. We talked about the community. We talked about the hospital and the work environment. And when she asked me about malpractice costs, I had to tell her the truth. And frankly, she did some quick calculations in her head, and she told me that if she came to Fairbanks, it would cost her approximately $250,000 out of her total income over the next 10 years. And while she wanted to come to town, she wanted to help us address this physician shortage issue, she simply couldn't make that kind of a personal sacrifice. So in summary, we face the potential of a real healthcare system collapse in the next few years unless we can do something to bring new physicians into this community. And I believe that by passing SB 67, you will assist us in that task and give us a better chance of continuing to address the healthcare needs of the Fairbanks community. That concludes my remarks.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Slocum? Senator French?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Slocum, the malpractice premium increase you experienced last year from $259,000 to $638,000, what role did the Division of Insurance play in approving that rate increase?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't know what role they played in that at all. We had 2 insurance companies, both were the physician-owned mutual companies. We solicited bids from both, and we negotiated as hard as we could, and we still found ourselves with an extra $380,000 cost that has to be passed on to our community.
Okay. Thank you very much. Senator French, is there a question?
Thanks. Just one follow-up question. You gave us a lot of statistics about physician availability. Mainly there in the Fairbanks area. It sounds like we're doing a little better down here in Anchorage. But I guess my question is, and if you don't have this information at your fingertips, you can send it down to my office or to the chairman, and he'll distribute it to the rest of us. But I guess my question is, can you show us a link between medical malpractice caps and doctor availability? That is, can you go to the jurisdictions in the United States that have no caps that allow patients to sue for full recovery of their damages and find that doctors are fleeing those jurisdictions in favor of, for example, California, Texas, and other states that are putting hard and low caps on?
Well, Senator French, I don't have that specific information about other areas of the country, but I have a couple of answers. One is that I do have personal experience in recent weeks, as I mentioned, where we had a doctor who was interested in coming to town and practicing here and assisting us who did not come, specifically because the practice cost was so much higher here in Alaska than it was in Wisconsin. And then in general, I think it's intuitively obvious that there are many barriers to recruiting physicians into interior Alaska, and that if we can remove one of those barriers or lessen the impact of the cost of malpractice, we'll be in a little bit better position than we might have been otherwise. Doesn't mean we'll get all that we want, but I think, as I said in the opening remarks, we have to start from where we find ourselves, and we welcome any small effort that you can provide to assist us in dealing with this crisis.
Senator French?
Maybe you could go to your town council or your borough, Mr. Slocum, and try to do a cap there in Fairbanks, and we'll keep
Senator French, you know better than that.
Sorry, it was more of a joke, Mr. Slocum. Thanks for being here.
Other questions for Mr. Slocum? Senator Grass.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Slocum, you had said you had one case go to arbitration. Can you comment on whether or not that went to the review panel that we've discussed here that's in statute? And if it hasn't, whether or not you've ever made the conscious decision to use the review panel and not use it, and why?
I believe that the case in question was settled before actually coming to trial rather than at the review panel level. But typically, the attorneys have a lot to do with making that decision in terms of their assessment of the worth of the case and the difficulty of defending or proving the allegations. And in general, it seems that our experience in the 6 years I've been here reflects the experience in the nationwide of less than one out of five verdicts for the plaintiff.
Okay.
Questions? Go ahead, Senator Guess.
Thank you. And you had mentioned we've discussed here a lot about access to insurance companies and rates. Do you have any information, because we have yet to get any here at the committee, that either shows that if we put in a cap, the two companies that are here won't leave, or if we put in a cap, more insurance companies will come to Alaska and therefore rates will go down?
Well, I have no proof of that. I think we can kind of argue that the converse of it, that the more difficult we make it for the defendants in these cases, the less likely people will want to remain or come to town. I simply, again, would suggest that while this may not be a cure-all, this may not guarantee that we can solve our physician shortage problem, it's a welcome move in the right direction, which intuitively seems to be a help in addressing that question.
Thank you. And I guess just to respond, as an economist, I guess it's not as intuitive for me that the market will work the way you think it is, but that's why we have this process. If I would make one request, the study that you spoke about on graduates, and I think those were graduates, not practicing physicians, if it's possible to either fax or email that down, I would love to see it. From research that I've done, there's a shortage nationwide of certain types of physicians, especially general practice and internal medicine, and in certain areas of the state. And I would be interested in seeing the study that you spoke of.
I'd be happy to send it to your office. Senator, it's not a study, it's rather an editorial in the magazine, but I suspect that the biggest issue is that of a maldistribution. So the fact that there are too many plastic surgeons in Beverly Hills doesn't really negate or assist us in getting interns to treat our elderly sick folks here in Alaska.
And if you'd forward that to the chairman's office, we'll get it distributed to all the members. That'd be good.
Do that, Senator. Thank you.
Mr. Jordan is our last person. Mr. Jordan, are you there?
Chairman Seacup, this is Jim Jordan. Can you hear me?
We can hear you, Mr. Jordan. If you'll put yourself on the record, we're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
Thank you, sir. For the record, I'm Jim Jordan. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska State Medical Association. And we have previously provided written testimony in regards to Senate Bill 57, which I will reiterate that we continue to espouse the strong support. I'm going to try to be brief today because we have provided previous testimony. However, I would like to start with answering a question that Senator Getz had at the hearing on March the 8th, and that was, which six states had fewer doctors per capita than Alaska? Those six states are Idaho, Oklahoma, Mississippi, Nevada, Wyoming, and Iowa. And I will probably come back to that in just a moment, if I may. But I would like to make a few comments about several issues that have been discussed today and in previous hearings. First of all, there was some discussion last Thursday involving the viability of a MICA-type approach or solution for insurance company availability. I, in a previous reincarnation, when I used to work for the State Division of Insurance, sat and represented the Division of Insurance on the MICA board. And as had been discussed at the last hearing, that there were some rather large numbers involved in potentially looking at retooling at MICA. However, the piece of information I would like to impart is that one of the reasons why MICA disappeared, if you will, and it disappeared in effect by transferring its business to NorCal, which is one of the two remaining insurance companies here in the state providing coverage to physicians, was that MICA was an effective victim of its own success. It produced positive gains from operations, and the Internal Revenue Service decided that it needed to be taxed federally. And there was concern when this issue came up by the then Attorney General Bailey and the governor that that same theory would also be applied to other state or quasi-state organizations. The one that was centered about most was the permanent fund. The next item I would like to talk about is the panel, the expert advisory panel. When this was instituted, and it remains in statute, the administrative process in statute rested with the clerk of the court. And the clerk of the court were unable to effectuate that process. So through letter agreement, the Alaska State Medical Association agreed to do that in as far as working to empanel physicians. And as had been previously testified to, that was a very difficult task in that we have a small number of physicians to begin with. That was further exacerbated by a conflict questionnaire that was implemented that, amongst other things, essentially conflicted out any physician who had been represented by one of the few defense lawyers in this state. But probably the crowning blow that really impacted the viability of the panel was the fact that in later years of the panel's operation, the physicians who served on the panel were several years after the fact, were subpoenaed and were required to appear at very contentious depositions without legal counsel unless they went out and hired their own counsel. I would also like to briefly mention economic damages, in that there's been a lot of discussion about particularly children or housewives not having economic damages. Now, I'm not an attorney, but it's my understanding that there is a jury instruction as part of the civil rule court that talks about earning capacity, and it's not lost wages. It's looking at what an injured party's capacity is to earn. So, in the example of a housewife who is not in the workaday world, but is a stay-at-home mom, earning capacity would be determined by what their training and education is. For example, if the stay-at-home mom was a trained petroleum engineer, that's how that would be arrived at. And also there are two Supreme Court cases that I'm aware of that deal with exactly that issue. One, a 1973 case, Morrison versus the state, and another, a 1982 case, Grimes versus Hatt. And there was also a concern about, what about the drunk doctor? I think that's the term that I heard the one testifier. Right? There are provisions currently in our law that have to do with punitive damages that, at least in my view, would address that situation. And we're looking at damages there that are in the neighborhood of the greater of three times any compensatory damages or $500,000. Or if the particular action was done, it was known by the defendant to be, reckless behavior, if you will, the amount of damages goes up to the greater of four times compensatory damages, or the four times the aggregate amount of any financial gain that were to be derived, or the sum of $7 million. So there are significant funds available for those types of situations. One other concern, and then I will go back to the six states that have fewer per capita physicians in Alaska, and that is, there's been concern expressed that, if the cap is established at $250,000, that this would impact the ability of people to go to court. In a study that was recently released February 28th, that was commissioned by the Californians for Californians Allies for Patient Protection, the conclusion reached in that particular study, which looked at the impact of what would happen or what the effect of the MICRA reforms that were established in 1976 were, and what would happen if that cap was significantly increased. The conclusions were in this study was that the impact of MICRA on a person's ability to find a lawyer and seek restitution was not materially impacted. And it also indicated that the insurance market was stabilized in California. And finally, one of the conclusions that is pretty stark is that were the cap to be increased in California to $500,000, it is likely that it would increase the health care costs of Californians by $6.5 billion. And this study will be popularly referred to as the HAM report, but its official title is MICRA and Access to Healthcare. Finally, I would like to just go back for a moment to the questions about what are the impacts of potential impacts of instituting a $250,000 cap. Now, there are some as far as I know, there are no direct studies that will directly answer those questions that have been posed. But by anecdote, I will refer to Idaho, which is has the lowest number of physicians per capita, who several years ago reduced its cap to $250,000. First of all, two of the three insurance companies that left Alaska in the last 3 years also do business in Idaho and remain in business in Idaho. They left here, they stayed there. That's CNA and Northwest Physicians Mutual. Also, too, I know that this may not be a true indication, but let's look at the difference in the premiums. Between Alaska and Idaho, one of the major insurers in Alaska is MIEC. The differential in rates between Alaska and Idaho is such that Alaska's rates are 48% higher. I think that's a significant factor in attempting to look at recruiting physicians. And if I could just quickly, Texas, who recently instituted CAP. And I heard Congressman Michael Burgess speak a week ago today in Washington, D.C., and he's a congressman for Texas. He indicated that before the Texas reforms came into place, they went from 17 to 2 active writers of medical liability insurance for physicians. That is now back up to 14. Effect on rates. Texas Medical Liability Trust, Texas's largest insurer, have had two rate reductions, one of 12% and an additional 5%. And also, he also indicated another interesting impact, and that is community hospitals in Texas are primarily self-insured, according to Congressman Burgess. And he indicated that in the 18 months since the Texas reforms have come in, they have realized the savings of $22 million. And interestingly enough, Congressman Burgess also referred to a conversation that he had with an OBGYN who worked in Nome. And that this OBGYN told Congressman Burgess that he was unable to do C-sections in Nome because they didn't have an anesthesiologist in Nome, and it was because they couldn't afford one, and they couldn't afford the premiums for the coverage. And also, I had a conversation with Dr. Bon Allen, who is the current president of the Texas Medical Association. And he related to me that in a pediatric specialty hospital outside of Corpus Christi, who was severely short of pediatric specialists, in the last 18 months have been able to recruit 47 pediatric specialists to this hospital. And Dr. Allen also indicated that the Texas Joint Underwriting Association has just reduced its rates by 10%. So with that, I will be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Senator Theriault.
Would you go back over the information that you had on the punitive damages? And the bill the bill talks about the non-economic damages, but you went over some facts on what under the statute would be allowed under punitives.
Through the chair, Senator Theriault, if it would be easier, I can give you a statutory site.
Yeah, that'd be fine.
Sure. It's AS09. 17.020, and you can look at, well, that's the section that deals with punitive damages.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Gass.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Jordan. I appreciate you stating some case law on stay-at-home moms. Is there case law that you know about and off the top of your head on how these damages of future economics have worked for children?
For children?
Yes.
Okay, I don't have any case law. All I can state is that the Alaska State Medical Association's attorney, who we retain, he's our outside counsel, also does medical malpractice awards. And he indicated that that it is very unusual for the plaintiff and defense to differ on what the value of future economic earnings are, and that includes children. But I have no case law.
Okay.
I just say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator French.
Was Senator Guest finished?
I thought so.
I have some questions on some other issues. But
okay, I'm sorry. I apologize. I thought you were done there. Go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Jordan, I would just, if it's at all possible, I would appreciate maybe you sending us the HAM report that you mentioned, if that's possible to fax or email it to us.
If you want to get that to our office, we'll get it distributed, Mr. Jordan.
Okay, Senator Deakins, I believe that was emailed to you yesterday.
Is that which one is that now?
The title of the report is called MICRA and Access to Healthcare. And it's popularly called referred to as the HAM report. Who's okay. One of the authors.
Did we get that?
It's possible.
It's possible that we have it. We haven't gotten through all of our emails the last couple of days.
and I apologize, but it's about 50 pages long.
All right. We'll get it out.
Oh, good.
And then I just have a quick question about the letter that you sent, and I appreciate you coming back with those six dates. On page 2 of the letter, you discuss the WAMI program, and many of us that grew up here know people have gone on to the WAMI program and come back to Alaska, many people that have come to Alaska because of the WAMI program. Given the shortage of physicians, should something we look at as legislators, should we look at increasing the number of places in for WAMI for Alaskans, or trying to get different partnerships similar to WAMI so we bring and we import more physicians to Alaska?
Senator Guest, through the chair, yes, I agree that I think that we need to look at expanding WAMI and looking at potential other partnerships. Realizing too that this is still only one piece of the puzzle, but the pipeline to produce a physician is a long one. And, if you just ignore the 4 years of undergraduate work that is necessary, you're looking at, 4 years of medical school, and the shortest graduate medical education program now is about 3 years. You're looking at, a seven-year pipeline. But I definitely think that's part of the solution that we need to look at. And, we're competing with other states for physicians, as was mentioned in earlier testimony about the now projected shortage of physicians in this country. And we're going to be competing with these six states that I mentioned, plus we're also really going to be competing with another state that I mentioned, and that's Texas. We're in this ranking, we're ranked 47th in the number of doctors per capita. Texas is ranked 43rd. And they have 8 medical schools, countless residency programs. So, we have some hard competing to do.
Yeah, but we're bigger.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Jordan.
Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Jordan, you finished your testimony talking about rates and the potential effect that this bill might have on malpractice rates. The information, or at least some of the information we've gotten, we've been deluged with information on this bill, but some of the information we've gotten included a series of quotes from leading malpractice insurers who are much more cautious about their statements regarding what this bill might do to rates. And I guess I just want to give you some of that information. Bob White, the president of the First Professional Insurance Company, the largest medical malpractice insurer in Florida, stated that, quote, no responsible insurer can cut its rates after a medical malpractice tort reform bill passes, unquote. And that was quoted in the Palm Beach Post. A Cliff Webster, representing the Washington State Medical Association and chairman of the Washington Liability Reform Coalition, told the Washington State Legislature, House Judiciary Committee in 2003, quote, I don't think we would argue that premiums are likely to go down, unquote. And there's a couple more quotes like that in this document we've been given. I'm just curious how you square those sort of leading professional representatives of the industry's view of rates with the information you have.
Senator French, through the chair, as I testified in another committee earlier this year, I guess that I would say on a ceteris paribus situation, I think probably rates would decrease. But we don't have a ceteris paribus situation, which means all other things remaining equal. There are other impacts that will drive the rate. For example, the Medical Insurance Indemnity Exchange of California, which is one of the two remaining insurers in this state, in their notice to policyholders for their rate action for this year indicated the cost of defense in the most recent five-year period increased by 33% over the previous five-year period. So there are a number of factors that come into play. However, one interesting piece of information, and this comes from the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and that is looking at the trend line of what's happened to premium rates and looking at California with the rest of the country. From the period of 1976 through 2002, the rest of the country's professional liability insurance rates for physicians increased 750%. The same time in California, the increase was 245%.
Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Jordan, for your testimony. Senator Terrio.
Thank you. I'm looking at this section of statute that you made reference to, and just want to make sure that I'm understanding it correctly. You talked about the section that allows for four times, the compensatory damages. But it looks like, if the fact finder determines that the conduct proven under B of this subsection was motivated by financial gain, and the adverse consequences were actually known by the defendant. So if you have a doctor who, you know, the example that we're giving is, you know, cuts off the wrong leg, I don't know that action was motivated by financial gain or the adverse consequences of the conduct were actually known by the defendant. So I don't know that you could realistically expect to get down to subsection G of that statute. Then, of course, you also have section J, that if you get punitive damages, the court shall require that 50% be deposited into the state general fund. So it seems like there are, you know, the opportunity for punitive damages, but it is limited to the upper sections of that. Would you disagree with that?
Not being an attorney, I'm not good at interpretation, but I would think that attorneys such as Mr. Burdings, who's very able counsel, would probably find all sorts of ways to argue in the case of the example you gave to seek those damages.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions for Mr. Jordan? Hearing none, thank you very much, Mr. Jordan. We appreciate your time here today. And with that, I don't see anyone else that signed up for public testimony, so we're going to close public testimony on this bill at this time. And members have asked for about a 3 or 4 minute break, so if we'll just take a short recess. Back on the record for 67, I have a couple of suggestions I'm going to work with a couple of the parties on, and we'll bring that back up here in the near future. So we're going to 70, and we've got Senate Bill number 70 is a governor's bill. I see that the Department of Law is here to introduce us to this bill. Well, if you'll put yourself on the record, then we'll be eager to hear your introduction this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dean Guinelli with the Criminal Division of the Alaska Attorney General's Office. Senate Bill 70 is before you. It's commonly been referred to as the governor's methamphetamine bill. It actually covers more than methamphetamine, and I'll get to that as I go through the bill. In general, it's a narrowly tailored bill. There are a number of ideas reflected in other bills in the legislature that address the methamphetamine issue more broadly, putting restrictions on pseudoephedrine and imposing some requirements on businesses to restrict the sale of pseudoephedrine. The governor's bill does not do that. We certainly have witnesses available to answer questions about those kinds of restrictions, but that's not part of the bill we have today.
If I could just for clarification, we're looking at the current draft is / G for golf. Am I correct, golf?
That's what I have, Mr.
Okay,
Chairman.
Thank you.
Right. This is the Hess CS for right. Senate Bill 70.
Thank you.
If I could just go through the bill briefly, I'd be happy to answer questions, and I've got some suggestions for an amendment that I think would make one provision of it more effective. Section 1 of the bill really addresses all forms of drugs that get manufactured or sold in Alaska. And essentially what it says is that if you make drugs or if you sell drugs, and as a direct result of that, somebody dies from ingesting those drugs, but that's manslaughter. We've had difficulties prosecuting these kinds of cases, these kinds of overdose, essentially they're overdose cases. They often happen with heroin. is one of the most common overdose drugs. And we've had difficulty prosecuting cases like this as homicides, and the question is what level of homicide is it? Because we believe that manufacturing and selling drugs of this nature is reckless behavior, we believe that it's appropriate to treat it at the manslaughter level, because manslaughter is a crime that is traditionally established by reckless conduct that causes somebody's death. These kinds of provisions in other states are treated in a variety of different ways, all the way from first-degree murder in some states, and other states second-degree murder, and other states manslaughter. Some of the states that have second-degree murder, or first-degree murder, I believe, are New Jersey and Florida, where I think the number of addicts and number of overdose cases, I think, is certainly higher than we see in Alaska, but those cases treat this kind of conduct much more seriously. So Section 1 is a provision that that deals directly, if we can prove where the drugs came from, if we can prove that you manufactured them or you sold them and someone dies as a result of that, they would be guilty of manslaughter. Section 2 is a slight defense to that crime of manslaughter, and this is as a result of Senator Dyson's comments in Senate Hess, where he asked the question, well, suppose you were just manufacturing drugs for your own use, you had them locked up in a safe in your house, somebody breaks into the safe in the house and steals those drugs and somebody dies as a result, why should you be liable? And although we thought that would be an unlikely scenario, or if it did occur, that it would be unlikely to be prosecuted, to satisfy his concerns, the affirmative defense in Section 2 was engrafted into the bill. Sections 3, 4, and 5 are provisions that directly relate to methamphetamine manufacturing. We have witnesses here from the Department of Public Safety who can testify about the dangers of methamphetamine manufacturing. Certainly they've been in the headlines recently in Alaska newspapers, Mat-Su Valley being called the meth capital of Alaska. I think the fact of the matter is that methamphetamine manufacturing is a dangerous activity. The chemicals are dangerous, the gases that they produce are dangerous, flammable, and sometimes explosive. And it gets into the walls of houses, it gets into the soil if you dump the residue out the back door. It's just an inherently dangerous activity. The kind of meth labs that are being seen around the country and in Alaska are very small, small operations. They're often being run by addicts who are supplying their own habit and then selling a little on the side to get more money or more product to cook even more. What Sections 3, 4, and 5 tried to get at would be those people who cook in a location where they, in a building where they know or they have reason to believe that there are children residing. We have found methamphetamine labs in hotels, in apartment buildings. I mean, just here in Juneau a couple of years ago, there was a family in one side of a duplex, and they started smelling something strange, and turned out that there was a meth lab right next door to them, and it ended up contaminating the whole house, and there were children living in that house. We believe that this is an aggravated offense, and Sections 3, 4, and 5, Section 3 defines building, Section 4 establishes the level of crime as a Class C felony, and Section 5 actually has the elements where you knowingly manufacture or attempt to manufacture methamphetamine in a building with reckless disregard that it's a dwelling for one or more children. I do have a proposed amendment for these sections because in giving this matter a lot of thought, I think there are some potential problems that might make it difficult to enforce this as it's intended, and it's really the chair's option. I could present those now, or I could after I get through.
Let's
the rest
get through
of
it, and we'll.
Okay. Section 6 addresses a specific type of methamphetamine that the troopers are seeing more and more of. It's commonly called meth oil. The The particular provision actually is at the very end of Section 6 on page 4, and this is a methamphetamine in an organic solution. It's found that the manufacturing techniques are evolving all the time. The type of methamphetamine and the way it's transported and the way it's used is changing all the time, and we're trying to keep our state laws on top of the most the common methods of using it and manufacturing it. And it was felt by the crime lab that we needed a specific provision addressing methamphetamine in an organic solution when you have it with intent to extract methamphetamine from it, rather than relying on current law. They didn't think that current law was adequate for that purpose. Section 7 is a section that was added in Senate Hess at the request of Senator French, and this deals with steroids. Currently, under Alaska law, steroids are not illegal. They are under federal law, and this provision in Section 7 conforms Alaska law to federal law. And it's often asked, well, if federal law is on the books, isn't that adequate? And I think that anybody in law enforcement or in prosecution knows that it's very difficult to get the federal authorities interested in prosecuting drug offenses unless the amount is particularly large or there's some other federal interest in that. So this deals with anabolic steroids that are abused by bodybuilders, by athletes. It's certainly been in the headlines a lot recently with baseball players. And in fact, there was an article in today's Juneau Empire about anabolic steroids being much more widely used among high school students than it was formerly believed. And I think the idea is if we prohibit it under state law, if state law can take action when it's found, that's going to lessen its impact on children, where I think the real danger is. And that is a quick overview of the bill, and I'd be happy to answer questions before we take up a proposed amendment that I've got.
Initial questions? Senator Huggins.
Sir, question for you on section number 7, reference steroids. Are you a smart guy, or maybe Senator French is a smart guy on steroids?
That's a loaded question. Why don't you ask the question first?
I'll certainly defer to Senator French on that.
Promote your muscle growth.
If you're asking whether Senator French uses steroids for muscle growth, I...
Come on now. Don't make me take my coat off now. Don't make me take it off.
No, I guess number one, I read this. It for some reason seemed like a strange mix, just based. But I suppose it may make sense in the long run. And I support discouraging kids from using Dianabol. I don't know whether it's a marketing name or it falls in one of these categories, which is it may be a marketing.
Where did you come across the name?
It's a kind of well-known bodybuilding steroid. I've happened to have read on that once upon a time.
I can tell you that this schedule we essentially lifted straight out of the federal statutes.
Yeah, I'd just be interested in Dianabol. It may be one of these. And the other one is, I don't think it's a steroid, but where does creatine fall in this? Because that's a favorite consumption item of kids.
You can
get
creatine at your grocery store.
Oh, I know. I know you can.
In the health food section.
Well, I know you can.
And it's not an anabolic.
No, it's not a steroid.
Not an anabolic steroid.
But it's a question. My point is not specifically creatine, but I mean there are lots of things that don't fall under steroids that have create some interesting dilemmas for your body.
There are definitely gray area substances that fall outside of the ones that are listed here, and the purpose of this list is to get us in line with the federal statutes, and we specifically, I guess, are intentionally aimed at the center of the target. That is, without trying to get off into the latest designer drugs that may be available at high-end sports institutes or whatever they may be, we're just trying to get to the commonly marketed anabolic steroids that you can get on the internet and that are available that have these known detrimental effects.
Sorry, I didn't mean to digress on that. Other questions at this point?
Actually, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Terrio.
On page 1, line 13, direct result of ingestion. My understanding that there's no definition for ingestion. Washington State specifies inhalation, injection, or dermal abrasion, or another way would be to say as direct result of the use of a controlled substance. But I guess the only thing that we've got talks about, you know, taking it through the mouth. And I'm wondering how.
Through the Chair, Senator Terrio, it was certainly the intent that ingestion would be a broader term than simply through the mouth, whether that be smoked or injected. It was not intended that ingestion be limited to through the mouth, because I mean that certainly wouldn't get to most. The most common way to ingest or to use heroin is certainly through injection. So to the extent that there's any ambiguity, certainly from our standpoint, the governor's intent, it was to cover all forms of use of the drug.
Was this also intended to cover the accidental ingestion of or the accidental use of, for an example, rather than just the deliberate use of?
Mr. Chairman, this bill was intended to get at the person who manufactures and sells the drug. If as a result of that, somebody uses the drug either in my view intentionally or unintentionally, or maybe a drink is, you know,
it causes harm.
If their drink is spiked with it,
right.
If they take, you know, if somebody gives them a date rape drug in their drink and they overdose from that, which has happened, that would meet the elements as well. We're focusing on the manufacturer, the seller, and the resultant harm, however that may occur, and with one caveat. A number of questions were asked in Senate Hess about, suppose somebody takes a drug and as a result of that, you know, drives recklessly and then kills somebody. That we do not believe is the direct result of the ingestion. That's an indirect result of...
This is not a consumer protection bill, in other words.
This is not.
Yeah, okay. Senator French first, and then Senator Terrio.
If I could just follow. So
Senator,
would you see a problem with using the word result of use of the controlled substance, just to clarify? It just seems like there's a possible problem there.
Through the chair, if by use we include the situation that Senator Seekins asked about, I mean, suppose somebody takes it unknowingly. I mean, suppose their drink is spiked. I mean, they really haven't used it, but they have ingested it.
Even if it's deliberate or accidental.
Deliberate or accidental. I mean, maybe that's the best way. Deliberate or accidental use would be an appropriate amendment. That would be.
Well, I'm open to suggestions. Yeah. It seems like this could just be a problem.
I was just trying to get to the point there where we didn't say only those people who deliberately use the drug. And I don't think that was the intent. Senator French next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Guarnelli, sometimes addicts inject each other with drugs, and I guess my question is kind of like Senator Terrio's about ingestion. That connotes to me sort of a voluntary, even if I don't know this has something bad in it, I voluntarily consume it, or I voluntarily smoke something, or if I inject myself, I voluntarily ingested it, or if we can change the phrase to be a little broader, that might be a good idea. But I would assume that this bill contemplates prosecuting someone who injects someone else with a drug and that other person dies as a direct result.
Through the chair, yes, Senator French, that was an intended consequence of this. If you inject somebody else, because often the person who does the injection is the one who liquefies the
measures
it, right. and controls the dosage of it, and so that would be intended, yes. Thank you.
Senator Huggins.
And you're dealing with this as far the question of the landlord that owns the sixplex that this is manufactured in. Is there a provision someplace in statute that covers that implication? It's the equivalent of setting a fire in the apartment, as I understand it, the poisoning effect of manufacturing.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, there's nothing that specifically talks about the landlord. In other words, the landlord is not liable.
The landlord being liable, the fact that the crime of essentially burning down the apartment because you poisoned it. And that's my understanding, the net effect of
civil liability for contaminating the property.
Is there any provision for that? There's nothing in this bill that does that.
No, I assume somebody asked that question in the process thus far. Is that's not true?
That's not the case. So far, the focus was on criminal penalties. The kinds of meth labs that are most dangerous, the small attic run labs that use the kind of very volatile toxic chemicals, the kinds that spring up all over. I think it was felt that those people are best dealt with through criminal penalties, and civil liability is probably not a very effective mechanism for dealing with.
No, I understand. I just wonder if you had a conversation and where it went. That's the first part. The second part, then, is I'm only going on what I've read that it has a very poisonous effect on an apartment. And you got to tear out and rebuild. Is that accurate? Is that
through the chair? That's correct. And there are state troopers here who could expand on that even more. But it's my understanding that the fumes can contaminate the wallboard, for example, so that perhaps the place would have to be torn down to the studs and insulation taken out, that sort of thing.
I think we addressed that about 2 years ago as to the physical damage and how it had to be repaired on a dwelling, if I'm not mistaken. But I'm going to have to look it up. Go ahead, are you done?
But the final part is that assuming there is a poisoning effect, and then the subsequent residents there, let's just say that the person that manufactured meth in the apartment left undetected. Next group of residents move in. Is it potentially poisonous to that group of residents? And the question then is about the net effect of that.
Through the chair, it's my understanding that potentially there is a poisonous effect on the next set of residents. The extent to which that occurs, I think, depends a lot on how much it was done, how often it was done, how contaminated the site is. I have heard anecdotally, and I'd want to defer to the state troopers there is some odor that comes from the cooking process itself. Whether that is such to, and in fact, at least in the Juneau case that I referenced, that's how they first discovered the problem. There was an odor coming over to the other apartment. Whether that odor persists such that somebody would be clued into the fact that there might be a problem, I don't know. But that's not something that we have specifically addressed here.
I'm just looking for full accountability for those who break the law. And it may not be appropriate. I'm just asking you about whether you had that discussion. Thank you very much.
Questions, really.
We're going to Mr. Guanella before we go. Well, Senator Guest, I don't want to interrupt your thought.
Thank you, Chair Seekins. I just refer Senator Huggins. 4 years ago, or I think it's 284, but you can either look under my name, and two legislative sessions ago at Jim Holmes' name, last legislative session, we passed a bill on ensuring that meth labs that were busted were cleaned up before they were reoccupied. And so it talks a lot about the issues you're talking about, and it talks about being able to go after the renters for some of the costs. So anytime you want to talk about that issue, we did discuss it two legislative sessions ago and last legislative session.
About the subsequent part of that, if let's just say the lab wasn't discovered, next set of tenants move in.
Unfortunately, in our bill, it started with the bust because that's where we knew that there was. But it is very dangerous for people who, or it can be very dangerous for people who reoccupy a place if they don't know that the meth lab's there. I did, and maybe we could address it next time Senator Shekin's want to discuss the word delivers and whether or not we've discussed at all people who don't know that they're delivering drugs or are forced to deliver drugs and that those type of situations. So maybe we can talk about that at the next hearing.
We will, and we will continue with this bill tomorrow morning at 8:30, Senator Terrio.
Just quickly, in the dictionary, the word ingest, to take in or as if by swallowing. So swallowing. And then I'm not sure whether this proposed amendment takes care of some concerns that were flagged by my staff about jumping between building and dwelling.
Right.
And if you have kids, you know, that are over at the boyfriend's house where they're making meth, you know, are they taken in because they're not dwelling there? But anyway, there's some concern there. You might want to talk to Heather in my office.
Okay, with that, we're going to carry this bill over till 8:30 tomorrow morning when the Judiciary Committee is adjourned.